Okay, now it's my pleasure to introduce Mike, our speaker. So everybody give him a good hand. Yay. Come on, Mike.
Knock him dead.
Ooh, that Charlotte got good hugs. I'm coming back. I'm Mike, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Dang, y'all are a good-looking crowd.
Rigorous honesty.
My kind of folks. My kind of folks. I would like to thank the committee very much for inviting me out here to the Now Club's 28-year gratitude meeting. And we're going to talk a little bit about some gratitude in my little talk I got, because I didn't have none when I got here, and I got a whole lot of it now. So,
love you, Mike.
Love you too, Tommy. Imagine this in your mind. A hot Alabama courtroom in Alabama. Windows are open. It's hotter than it is outside. It's a courthouse. Bob walks up before the judge there for another DUI. Judge looks down and says, "Bob, I ain't believing you're here again." And a big old fly come flying in the room, you know. Started flying around the judge's head, and it kept aggravating the judge. The judge started swatting at it. He said, "Dadgum, what kind of fly is it? The crazy looking thing?" And Bob said, "Your Honor, if I might..." He said, "That there's what they call one of them there Zuzu flies." And the judge said, "A Zuzu fly? What kind of fly is that, Bob?" He said, "Well, Your Honor, that's a fly that likes to hang around a horse's butt a lot." And the judge said, "Bob, you might be calling me a horse's ass." And Bob said, "No, sir, Your Honor, but them Zuzu flies are hard to fool." Hard to fool. Yeah. I like to laugh in Alcoholics Anonymous. I come out of a cold room for about 10 days when I was in a treatment center. And they finally coaxed me to come out. "Well, Mike, you need to come out here and get with the rest of the community." And right as I walked out the doorway, everybody started laughing. And I ran back in. I thought they were laughing at me. You know, I was so beat down by alcohol, you know, and other little things I indulged with. But I'm an alcoholic, you know. I'm originally from Pontotoc, Mississippi. We lived in the country. It's an old dirt road, and I believe it's still an old dirt road. And my mom came to Crawford Long Hospital to have me. Born June the 3rd, 1947. I was 72 years old, June the 3rd. I ain't giving up a day. I am not giving up a day. I earned every bit of it, you know. But we moved back to Pontotoc, Mississippi there when I was about 3. And my heritage, we trace it back, and it's got a lot of Choctaw Indian in it. You know, there was a band of 10,000 Choctaws that lived there on the riverbanks of the old Mississippi River in the backwater there back during the day. And my grandmother on my dad's side had a lot of Choctaw Indian in her. Now, I'm going to tell you exactly how she looked. She was a scary woman, I'm going to tell you what. She had long, black, stringy hair, little old bitty brown, beady eyes. She was dark skin and wrinkled from the sun, you know. And she had this wart that grew. It was about 3/4 inch long, and it had 3 thick hairs growing out of the middle of it. And I used to be amazed, and she'd catch me looking at her. "What are you looking at, boy?" And I said, "Oh, nothing, you know." She said, "I'll jab your eye out with it." And I was actually afraid of my grandmother. I actually saw her with a pair of scissors. She would hold them out, and she would trim them. And even as a kid, I said, "Why don't she just take a razor blade, cut that sucker off, throw a little alcohol on it, put a Band-Aid on it, and be over it?" But I believe she liked that wart. But anyway, this is the kind of kid I was. I was into everything. Don't tell me not to do nothing, because I'd go right and do it. That's just the way I was, just mischievous as I could be. Well, you know how little boys are. And she had azaleas growing down the back porch on that old farmhouse. It was big old thing, you know, and she trimmed that by hand with little snippers and a knife and scissors, you know, and it was just level and all pretty different azaleas. She was out there sweeping one day. She had a homemade 14-inch wide broom, big old broom, and she was out there sweeping. And I was running from one end of that and running to the other end and jumping over them azaleas. And I'd already jumped over them and cleared them by 2 foot three times. And she come out there and said, "Boy, you better not fall in them azaleas." And she went back in, and I got back and ran. She came out on the porch about 3 feet before I started to jump them azaleas. She said, "Boy, I told you!" And I landed right in the middle of them azaleas. And I fought my way out of it. I heard her coming with that 14-inch broom, you know, and "I'm going to get you." And I thought she was going to stick that frog gig on the nose of me. And I run down this dirt road, and it scared my mother to death. They were both running down there, and I could run pretty fast at 3 year old, you know. And Gran, she finally got me, and she grabbed me, and she had her. I see the little beady eyes geeking me with that pecking ass going, "Ah, oh, man." And my mother saved me and jerked me out from up under, you know. Jerked me out from up under, you know. God, oh my. I believe that's the reason I became an alcoholic. A little bit of fear there causes it, you know. But anyway, I was raised in an alcoholic home. My dad was a mean little dang Indian boy. I'll tell you what, he was mean as a snake. And a tough little short statue, and he threatened to scalp me several times. I'm lucky he didn't even have my hair. And he would catch us doing something wrong, you know, and he would whoop us. He'd give us whoopings like we never had them. He'd use the brass end of that belt, you know. And he'd get through whipping us, and then he'd do a war dance around us, you know. Boy, I was glad when he started doing that war dance, because I knew he was done with what he was doing, you know. And he was a rough little fella. 3 years old, I remember I was about 3 years old, and I heard a ruckus late at night, and my mom and dad were in the kitchen in a little five-room house. We'd done moved to Smyrna, Georgia by then. And mom was under there trying to cut the cold water on and off, had a leak or something, and she turned the hot water on it, and he didn't like it. And I was standing there, and he hit her in the head with the old washing machine lid, you know, the old washing machines with the two roller ringers, you know. And it had a round with a little hook. Dang, we got some old folks, if y'all couldn't remember that. No pun intended, you know. But he hit her over the head with that thing. And I remember that blood was rolling down her cheek, and he reared back to hit her again, and I yelled out, "No!" And he saw me standing in the shadows of that light there, you know. And said, "What are you doing there, boy? You get back to bed," you know. And I went and hid in the closet, you know. And I don't really mean to take anybody else's inventory, but this is part of my story. And I was just afraid of my dad. You know, they would argue, and, "Why do you have all these kids, you know, and all this stuff, you know?" And said, "We ought to kill them, you know." And we'd run in the closet. There's four of us, actually five of us, but there was Stanley, a year older brother than me, then Joyce, and then Sheila. And 2 weeks out of the year, our ages was like 3, 4, 5, and 6, you know. And then Philip came later on, you know. But when Dad would come home drunk raising Cain, we'd go hide in the closet, in a dirty clothes closet, you know, and had a big closet in that little five-room house, and we'd throw it in, be real quiet, you know, and try to dodge the hysteria, you know, and all the drama, you know. But, the only time my dad was really comfortable is when he fished. He loved to fish. And he took me fishing with him. He was a different guy. I mean, he was just different. It seems like in his alcoholism, he could get to a river and fish and do that, and he was comforted by that. And he only told me one time in my life that I remember that he told me that he loved me. And I remembered that. And it felt good. It really did. And I can still remember it because the day he said it where we were, because I've got this photostatic mind that I can just go right back there, you know, this great alcoholic head on me. And I tied old square knot on my hooks, you know, and every once in a while a fish would slip my hook, and he said, "Let me see that knot, Huck." He called me Huck for Huckleberry Finn, because I'm always running around in the woods. And he said, That ain't gonna work, Huck, he said. Let me show you how to tie it. And he showed me how to tie what's called a double clinch Palomar fishing knot. You run it through two, roll it around five times, stick it back through, put it, spit on it, cinch it up, cut the tie ends off. We got some fishermen. I see a lady down there that knows how to fish up there. But I never slipped a fish on that knot he taught me. And that was love to me. That was him sharing me love, you know. And I remember one time he wasn't catching no fish, and I ran off with my fishing pole and found some old stick-ups in the water from a lay-down, and I brought back a string of about 30 crappie and walked up. And he said, Huck, where'd you get them crappie at? I caught them down there by that stick-up in the water. Lord, son, I said, you did good, you know. And I got a little more praise for my dad, you know. And I'll flash fast forward. This alcohol has brought down through the genes, I believe. But I was fearful, angry, had a love-hate relationship with my dad, and I didn't like people. I just didn't like being around people, especially adults. And so my first drink was, let me back up just a little bit. All the fighting and fussing and going on and playing with guns around the house and everything, pointing at people. So I said, I'm going to divorce this family. And I was about 10 years old and 12 years old. And I just left, and I went down the road and was staying in a basement of a house, with these two twin boys. They were both blonde haired, blue eyed. Their name was Larry and Barry. And they were so identical. The only way I could tell them apart is they fought all the time. Is when they got in a fight and Barry started crying, well, that was Barry. And their father was divorced, and he was an alcoholic too. And there was a man staying there in the basement there, you know, and he was giving Larry and Barry beers, you know. And so one time Larry come by, and I guess the guy told him to do it, but he put a beer down and said, drink that. And it was a Budweiser. You needed a church key for it. That's so long ago it was, you know. And this was in 1959. And I drank it. It didn't taste good at all, but I got it down. I said, whatever you do, you got to get it down. Breathe, get it down. I got it down. And I went downstairs. I was feeling sick, and I went downstairs. And they had this little feist dog. He was a little 35-pounder named, just an old feist dog. His name was Butch. He was light brown. And I was sitting there, and I was sitting on the couch down there in the block basement, and had the door open. I bent down there like that. Butch come up. You know how a dog will tell something wrong, and he'll come up and look at you, and I'm looking at Butch. And I said, oh, Butch, I don't feel too good. And he's going, you know how they look at you like, what you mean? He made that upswing, and I sprayed that beer right between his eyes. He hightailed it out of there, and he scooted through grass forever. He'd scoot on one side, scoot on the other. I said, God, I hope I didn't burn Butch's eyes out. But you know, I remember what that alcohol, how that alcohol made me feel. When it went down, it just a warm feeling and come all the way up to my head. And I said, golly, I think I'll go up there and beat my old man's ass. And it done for me what I couldn't do for myself, you know. Golly, and I said, this is what life's all about. Elvis probably drinks these things. You know, and I was off to the races. And I remember that first drink just as clear as it was, you know. And that's what it done. It worked for me. It took away all my fear. It took away my resentment of old folks. The heck with them, with adults. It's just the heck with them, you know. And everywhere old Larry and Barry would go, you know, we'd bring old Butch with us, you know, and I always mess with him, you know. So I'd say, hey, Butch, and he'd go serpentine and run around in circles, you know. He said, I'm watching you. I'm watching you. I got up about, I was a gearhead. We're going to fast forward. Fast for me, I'm busy. Dang, that's good coffee. I got in my teenage years, 14, 15 years old, and I got me an old 55 Chevrolet. And I think you could drive when you're 16. I was driving into the package store with that thing at Pop Store in Ackworth, you know, and I'd pull in there 14 years old, actually. And so what can I do for you? And I said, give me a six-pack of Budweiser. And he'd give them to me and sell them to me. And I'd come back about 4 or 5 hours later, pull in that old 55 Chevrolet, old motor just rumbling. Give me another six-pack, Pop. You sure you can handle it? I said, I drove in here, didn't I? And he'd give me another one. You know? But I was a gearhead. I was always up under the hood of a car, had a nice car, old 55 Chevrolet. It was Hugger Orange with a black vinyl top, had a 350 in it that would just scream. It would scare you with a four-speed in it, posi rear end. And we was up at a party one night. This was when I was 20. I was 20, yeah. I was at this party one night. It's a drinking party, a bunch of teenagers, you know. That was back during the hippie days, back in the 70s. Boy, them was good years there. And I had his trailer up at Red Top Mountain up there, and it was mostly guys, but this guy, Tommy, came in. He was a friend of mine. He come in the door. He had this good-looking, tall, blonde-haired, blue-eyed girl with him. I mean, she was a knockout. And I opened the door for her, and I had I had bell bottoms that was blue stripes and tan stripes down it, a real light, hot purple shirt, flared with the long cuffs on it, you know, with the tree buttons. I had shoulder-length hair, pork chop sideburns coming off here that went down like this and just blended into my mustache. And I mean, she walked through that door there, and she grabbed me up on a collar like that, and she looked me up down, and I said, hey there, you're next. And I'm 20 years old. I'm a gearhead. I crawl around under hood cars. I don't know what next is. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, Tom left that night, and old Tommy left that night, and he said, hey, Mike, how about... Could you run Debbie home? Said, I got something else to do. Said, yeah, I can take her home. She lived down in Atlanta down there, you know, and we talked on the way. We had a lot in common, really. She was easy to talk to, easy to look at. And when we pulled her to a house over there, she wrote her number down, put call me on it, and stuck it in my top pocket. So I left there and found it. Payphone about 2 blocks later away, and I called her. I wanted to know what next was all about. You know? Anyway, we went on long air, and I went home up on the hood a little more, gearhead, you know, and I called her, and we made a date, and she said, stop and get some beer. I said, okay. I went by Pops and got a six pack. Well, we went and parked, and we sat there and drunk a few beers, and I had these white bucket seats in this 55 Chevrolet. And she said, let's get in the back. And it scared me. I'm thinking, what does she want to get back there for? And she said, come on, there's more room in the back. And she crawled in the back and grabbed my car. Come on, come on, Mickey. And I really didn't want to go back there. But I did. And I tell you one thing, she done for me what I couldn't do for myself. I'm going to tell you what's the fact. Here I was. Here's my feelings on this. I'm 20 years old. I have this really hot girl and who has explored my activity beyond the hood of a car. And I've got this nice car. And I'm drinking. And life is really good. I mean, you remember those? I'm sure y'all remember those days. Life is really good. Life is really good. Well, we went along dating, and she wanted me to come over to her house because her mama was gone out of town. Okay. Bring some beer. Okay. So we in there, and we was in her mother's bed. She had a big bed. And her mother opens the door and cuts the light on. And the only thing between me and Debbie and her mother, who carried a .38 chrome pistol in her pocketbook, I knew that. The only thing we had between her was a sheet. No clothes. And she, I remember, I just had a flashback. Debbie's mother said, "All right, mister, right here, right now." I grabbed as much of that sheet as I could and tried to take it with me, but Debbie wanted it worse than I did. "Them women can lock up with them things here, and you're not going to get them off." And there I was, standing out there in all of my glory. I was gone. The best way I can explain it, if you see a turtle across the street and slap him on the shell, where does his head go? I was non-extinct. And she was actually looking at me with a little, And she said, "Here's the way it's going to be. You're 20 years old. She's 15. I didn't know that. You either marry her or you go to jail." I thought about it 2 seconds, and I said, I do. And she took us down to get blood tests, and we got married and stayed married 2.5 years. I was working at Lockheed Martin building airplanes. You know there's drunks out there building airplanes? We build a doggone good airplane. You know, and that Debbie, she was a piece of work. She was a wild child, I found out. And I got to thinking, I think they set me up on this bedroom job. I think they had that planned, you know. I really do believe that, you know. But anyway, what the heck did I care? We had 2.5 years together, and then we went and parted our ways and got divorced. My drinking got heavier. I could really say I became a full-blown alcoholic when I was probably 19 years old. And I think that's really when it happened for me. And but I said, girls ain't working out. I'm going to got back under the hood of that car, you know, and just drank, rode around, listened to the radio and stuff like that. And a couple of years went by, and I was out there working on the car. And these two girls come by in a Camaro, and they kept, every time they come around, they blowed right at the top of the driveway. And I said, "Who is that?" They came around about 5 times. So I went out there 6th time, didn't have no shirt on, had grease on me, and I stopped them. Had 3 little hairs right there on my chest. I think that's hereditary from my grandmother. No. And anyway, I said, "Did your parents teach you that it's not polite just to ride around, blow at guys, and introduce yourself, you know?" And her name was Marilyn. She was a little green-eyed girl from Kennesaw, Georgia. Light brown hair. Pretty girl. And my mother, we started dating. And my mother picked her, said, "That's going to be your wife right there. She's a good Christian girl. Good Christian girl, and she'll make you a good wife." And heck, I married her. You know. Before we got married, though, the police pulled me over up there and for another DUI, and I didn't stop. Marilyn was in the car with me. That old 55 Chevrolet was fast. I said, "I'll just outrun them." I took off, and they was out of the car and wanted to check my license. I said, "Nah, ain't checking them today. Put it in first gear and blow gravel all over the hood of the car," and went down through to Mill Village, and I had them beat. But a guy backed out of his driveway in a 64 Ford, and I hit him right in the trunk. My hood bowed up and it's steaming. I backed up and hit him again, pushed him in a ditch because he was in my way. And I went up on the tracks up there, and there's a dadgum train stopped across the tracks. Policeman got out tapping on the window with a .38, and she's screaming all the time, "Stop, stop, you're going to kill us. Stop, stop, you're going to kill us." You know. Well, they took me to the jail, took her down there to the jail. And old Whitey was policeman in Ackworth over there. And her dad come down there to get her. I heard him say, "You better get away from that little old half-breed Indian boy. You better get rid of him. He ain't no good. He's trying to kill you, you know." Of course, she loved me. Because I was we're a lot of fun. You know, drunks are a lot of fun. You know, drive fast, wreck cars, do all that good stuff. And then my mother came in there. Whitey called her, and she come down there, and I was standing behind them bars, and my mother walked up in them bars, and up on them bars, tears rolling down her cheeks, and she said, Son, you see what it did to your daddy? Said, you're going down the wrong road. My answer to that was my lame alcoholic excuse, you know. I said, Mom, if Whitey wouldn't pull behind me and put the blue lights on me uptown, I wouldn't be in jail, you know. You know, I didn't have no problem. It was him, you know. So, and my drinking got worse. Marilyn and I got married, and we got us a house. She taught me into getting a house, actually, first house. And my drinking got worse, and she was her mother died when she was young, and she had to take on all the chores and everything when she was 12 years old. And her dad was kind of real bossy and stuff, and I never could kind of figure out. I just couldn't get comfortable. It's like we couldn't get comfortable with one another, you know. And of course, my drinking didn't help. And she'd tell me to come home to eat. You know, are you gonna come home? I'll cook supper for you. But if you're not gonna come home, don't tell me to cook supper. I don't want to cook it. I said, I'll be home. Well, I got out of work and went by the bar over there. I didn't get home until about 11 o'clock. I walked in the door and sat on the couch drinking a beer. She brought my supper in there. Steak and gravy, mashed potatoes, green beans. She said, that looks good, don't it? And I said, yeah, it looks good. She went over and opened the front door and threw this stuff right out in the back. Before that stuff bounced twice, a neighbor's dog done eat it all up. But I understood what she was saying. I wasn't alcoholic enough not to understand that. She was getting pretty doggone fed up with my alcoholism, you know. I remember one night I come home drunk there, and I was leaning over that old toilet bowl with my head on that old toilet bowl, you know. That old toilet bowl so cool, you know. Throwing up, and I look over there, and she's standing in the hallway there. Got that Al-Anon stance going on. She's not even in Al-Anon. Got in that Al-Anon stance. Said, you need to quit drinking. Can't you see what you're doing to yourself? Can't you see what you're doing to yourself? My God. Why can't you quit drinking? And I told her why. I said, because you're sorry as hell. That's why. Because I wanted that monkey off my back. And she just tucked her head and walked away. You know. Where's the love? You know, you know. We ended up being married, for... like in 4 days, being 20 years. And I was 6 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got in a treatment center in Alcoholics Anonymous and got sober. But to back up a little bit, the things that I learned in my early sobriety was, I was in a treatment center. They put me in a cold room, stuck things in my arm that made me feel better. And they put me in a room. They two guys in a room at this hospital, at Parkwood Hospital out of Atlanta. And you had one bathroom. There's this little guy in the room with me. And I got it one night and sit on the toilet, and he'd peed all over the toilet, and I like it slipped off in the floor. And it, I was just on automatic. I went in there, and I grabbed him, and I shoved his head up the bed, and I said, you little shit, you, if you pee on that toilet seat one more time, you're going to be the first homicide here at Parkwood Hospital. Do you get that? And I was looking at his eyes, and he was scared. And I let him go. And he got up, and he walked out to a nurse's station. And he told him exactly what I'd done and exactly what I had said to him. You know, them folks in that treatment center know how to handle people like me, you know. Yeah. They come in and said, Mike, get your things. We're going to put you in another room. Okay. You know where they put me? He put me in a room with this ex-football player who was injured and had evidently drug problems. He's a black guy, black dude, you know. He was about 6'2", weighed about 225, you know. Raymond can pee anywhere he wants to. I don't have no problem with that. But you know, me looking back on that in my sobriety years after that, I was an undisciplined alcoholic. And I was disciplined. And I remembered that. And that helps me a bunch. If I'm in a bathroom and there's a two-holer in there, I'm going to wipe both seats off before I leave. Because I don't want nobody to go through that. You know? Nobody. Yeah, I'm a good alcoholic. I'm a clean freak. Well, Marilyn and I wasn't getting together, and we sit and had a little talk. I was 6 years sober. Well, let me tell you, let me go back. 3 years, I was 3 years sober, and my dad was a little rough on the edges, and I had sisters, and he was doing some things that they shouldn't be doing, you know, and I didn't know about it. I never didn't know a thing about it. And my sister was in the hospital, Joyce, and he had gotten her pregnant, is what it was. My little sister pregnant. She was 11 years old. And I thought she was in the hospital, but they told me she was in the hospital because she had ingrown toenails and was having it. She did have ingrown toenails. And I mean, I was close to my sister Joyce under me. We were just inseparable a lot of times, you know. And she was still in the hospital. She was in there to have that baby, you know. And she had that baby, and we never talked about it. I never talked about it to her, you know. Once I found out about it, and but God, I could imagine a child that young and having a baby, and you could only spend 1 hour, and then they take it away. And that's the throes of alcoholism, you know. So my dad was, I come home one night and I'd been drinking. Mama told me, said, son, you need to go outside. Your dad's trying to start something with Sheila, your other sister, you know. And I went out there and he slapped her out of the swing. She had a swinging and she wasn't but 10. And I'd been watching wrestling, so I body slammed him on the asphalt out there. He pulled a little old pen knife on me that probably wouldn't have hurt me. I probably could have took it away from him, but I told Sheila, let's go, and I went in the house. And my mother said, here, you may need this to protect yourself. And she put his pistol in my dad's pistol in my hand. And my dad come walking up to me in a rage, and when he did, I stuck that pistol right in his chest. And I said, the bullshit stops here. Everybody in the room said, shoot him. Shoot him. You know? And I'm glad I didn't pull that trigger. God, I'm glad. God was with me on that one. You know? God was with me on that one. Because I seen him for who I was. I looked into his eyes and he was an alcoholic and I had a problem. And we were kind of buddies, you know. We were buddies. We were buddy drinkers, you know. They called a couple of policemen over, and they said, well, we can't. We didn't see him do anything. We can't. And so my Sheila brought up that, well, my other sister's in the hospital. Let me tell you, police officers about this, you know. And he slapped her. And so they took him off and handcuffed him. He was just growling when they took him out the door. And I never seen him for a long time. Police officers told my mother that right a little out here what was happening, what's going on here, and I'm going to let him read it. And it basically said, don't ever step your foot in the house, this house, or see any of my kids or anything like that anymore. And he agreed to that, you know. And that hurt me, because there goes my fishing buddy. There goes my fishing buddy. And I cried and cried and cried. And I didn't find out really what was going on until after that, you know, all the gun deal. And through my sobriety, I'm talking to my sponsor, you know, and I'm saying, God, why did she put the gun in my hand? You know? I'm just a kid. He said, she wanted him dead. She wanted him out. She wanted out. She wanted out, you know. And that's just disease, but that's not the way it happened. My dad actually died in a sanitarium. He's 90 years old in 2009 at the Charles D. Plour Sanitarium in St. Charles, Louisiana. But I got to go. My sister Joyce died of cancer, and I spent some time with her. And she told me, said, if you see Dad, tell him I love him. Coffee will hold back the tears. And I told her I would. 3 years sober, I went and hunted my dad down. He was living in little apartments in a little town called Guntown, Mississippi. Guntown. Guns everywhere. They even named towns after him, by God, you know. Anyway, I went down there and knocked on his door, and he come walking out, and, you know, Dad, I figured I'd just come see you. I got something I want to tell you. And he said, what's that, son? It's good to see you. And I told him, I said, I sure do appreciate you telling me that you love me and taught me how to tie that double-clenched Palomar knot. And I've not always liked you, but I said, I love you. And he told me, I love you too, son. Coffee time. He said, you never give me any trouble. You're my favorite son, you know. I stayed with him a couple of days there, and he was still drinking vodka and starting to get crazy. So I got up one morning and left him $3 or $4 $20 bills up on the coffee maker. I didn't want to mooch off of him. Said my goodbyes the night before. And then I come back home. You know, and I go through all of that. I went through all of that. Well, I had to put the gun in my hand. God, I'm glad I didn't shoot him. Dang, I love my sister. You know? And I got to tell you all this. Never told it to anybody. I talked to Renelle the other day. You know, this is a Bible Belt down here. And we've got holiness and we've got Pentecostals. I was raised in a Pentecostal church. You know, my dad was actually a preacher. He'd sit us on the front row, you know, and he'd rain that fire down, brimstone down from that pulpit, you know. I lost my train of thought.
Pentecostal preacher.
Yeah, but I was getting to... Oh, yeah. Come back to me. This gratitude weekend is really a perfect match for me, because after going through my disease of alcoholism, my character defects, my fears, my resentments, hundreds of forms of this craziness that goes on in my head, you know, that I have learned that if I'm going to get any gratitude or any serenity at all, that I'm going to have to love everybody. Not just y'all. Everybody on the whole planet. Everybody. My enemies. I may disagree with them. I have to love them to get my head right, to where I can have gratitude and serenity and love. Because if I dislike anybody in my head, I'm going to have to deal with that in my head. And I don't like it in my head anymore. I don't like it there. It's no good. It comes, but I just let it flow back out. I just let it flow back out. And I love them all. My dad died, and nobody wanted to claim his body. Nobody. He had burnt so many bridges. And I said, my little sister, Sheila, who didn't like my dad at all, said, what are we going to do, Sheila? I said, well, we'll have him cremated and his ashes brought back down here. You know, and we brought his ashes back and took his ashes down on the river, and I learned the 23rd Psalm, the Lord is my shepherd thing. I sell my walk, you know, and scattered his ashes on the Etowah River, his favorite fishing hole, where he taught me how to tie that little double-clinched paddleman knot, you know, and that scattered his ashes there. And I believe that was a proper thing to do. Dignity. Dignity. And, so, Marilyn and I ended up getting a divorce. You know, we talked it out, and I said, we're not good. Do you really want to stay married to me? Well, no, I don't want to stay married to you. And so we went and got a divorce. I let her have the house, paid her car off, paid her bills, all her bills for like 90 days, and she's eventually ended up sold a house. She went out to the country, and Bowman over there found her a 6'1" blonde, blue-eyed country boy who's 10 years younger than this old man standing up here and married him. And I got jealous. Can you believe it? I got jealous. She's doing well. She's doing well. And I told myself, I'm not going to get married. Oh, I pray now, too, a lot. I pray a lot. I said, God, I don't know. I came not getting along with these women, and I don't know how to treat a lady. I don't know. And I'm not going to date no women. I guess I'm just going to fish and get back under the hood of that car and get a little grease on me. And I stayed sober. I stayed single for 13 years. I met one little old girl in a crowd of about 20 on a beach, you know. And I looked at her and she looked at me and there might be something there, and I picked her. And we dated for about 2 years. And that was the sickest little gal I've ever run up on. I don't know how I can do it, but if you put 20 girls up there, I'll pick the sickest one every time. I mean it's unbelievable the way I can do that, you know. But I said I wasn't gonna date again. Now I knew this lady sitting down here now, who's about, is gonna be our speaker in the morning. And I'd known Renelle a long time. I knowed her husband. We were best friends. We fished together and worked at Lockheed together. And I've loved her for a long time, but, you know, we're just friends, you know, just friends, just good friends, you know. And I said, I never was going to make nobody, you know. But anyway, this is her story, and I'm not going to tell her story. But my best friend, he passed away, and I actually got to do a eulogy at his funeral. And I was worried about Renelle because she'd been taking care of him, and her yard had got all, you know, weeds and all in it, and I offered to help her do her yard work for her, you know. And she just wanted to know which lawnmower you put oil and gas in and which one you put gas in. She didn't really want nothing to do with me. But I finally talked her into it. And I went down there to, we'd do grass and it'd be hot. And first time I went down there, she told me later that she dressed the ugliest clothes that she had in her closet. And she had the ugliest clothes on. I thought that was beautiful. You know? She was beautiful. I mean, hey, it was okay. And we was working on a yard there, you know, and time went by, and time went by, and time went by. And we were sitting out in the swing one day and drinking tea after we'd been working over there. And there's a mosquito lit right there on her leg down there. And I reached down there and I brushed that mosquito off. And God, her skin felt like silk. Like silk. Smoothest legs I'd ever felt in my life. She just make sandwiches there and we'd eat them. And so I said, I want to ask her out on a date, for dinner date, you know, take her out on a dinner date. She'd say yes or no, or get back to pulling weeds, you know. So I asked her out and she said, yeah, let's go to Old Charlie's. We went to Old Charlie's restaurant down the road there. And we went to Old Charlie's, you know. And I sit there, her with in a little table there. There was probably 150 people in that room, but she was the only one there. As far as I was concerned, you know, little angel sitting across from me, you know. Yeah. Anyways, we ended up, going to Jackson Hole, Wyoming on the Snake River and getting married in Jackson Hole, Wyoming in June the 5th. I never can. I got to remember that date, June the 5th. Y'all write that on your calendars, you know. And yeah, we got married there, Snow Cap Mountains. We got a preacher can't marry there. It has to be a judge, and he was a Vietnam vet, and he did this. Ranelle chose this beautiful little. It's kind of an Indian ceremony, you know, and it had little neat stuff in it, like and a brave will take his squaw into the tent, and he will shadow over her. And I said, Anyhow, we got married, and God, it's been good. We've had our little issues, you know, because alcoholic like me was still gonna be a little controlling, you know. I still like to control things, and then being a good Al-Anon, she says no, we're not gonna do it that way. No. I'd be going down the road, you know, and I'd say something and talk about somebody that wasn't good, and throw a few cuss words in there, and she'd say, "Hold it! What would God think about what you just said?" Here I am trying to make conversation, the wrath of an Al-Anon, and God is upon me. But I learned those things weren't appropriate to talk about. They weren't appropriate to say. They're negative things. She don't like negative. Weed it out. Throw it out. Helps me get better. So, you know, I learned by that, you know, just like I did put me in the room with Raymond. Yeah, discipline, you know, discipline. I need discipline. And I've got a lot of that in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's just unbelievable. I'm sponsoring a couple of drug appointees, young guys. You know, we used to go to prisons and with Doc, a good friend of mine. You know, we used to do that, go to prisons and do stuff. And this other guy, we're all on the second step, you know. And God is helping me more than anything. They tell me a little about themselves, you know, and they're young, you know. And I got to think, I'm 72. I said, I got to be kind of young with this. I can't be an old fart with it, you know. And I need to talk about stuff they're interested, you know, and let them talk and not me, because I like to talk and just listen to them, you know. And you really find some fascinating things about them, you know. And you wish them the best. And old boy told me, he said, Mike said, I want everything you've got. I said, you can have that. You can have it. Requires a little work, 12 steps, you know. Do a little prayer. We've already been through it, you know. Turn your will over to God. We're on step two now. God's as much a part of my life. My higher power is as much a part of my life as anything is now. It's my go-to. You know, I sit at a green light the other day, and a young girl sat through the green light texting. And I said, thank you, Lord. Said, I'm so retired, I'm thinking about throwing this watch away. I'm not in no hurry for nothing. I'm not going to get angry about that, you know. But I used to just go crazy over crap like that, you know. And when Joyce, the thing I was going to tell you that I never told anybody, that's where I got off track at a while ago. Yeah. My sister was a devout Pentecostal, which is what my mother was. And they believe in speaking in these tongues. Now, this is not no religious thing. AA is not religious. So this is just an experience that I had with my sister. And a couple of weeks before she died, she sat up in her bed and held my hands in her face. And she said, Michael, she said, you keep going to AA that they made a man out of you. You're totally different. You're different, you know. And she spoke in tongues, like the Pentecostals do. And the wording was beautiful. But I didn't understand what it said. I mean, I didn't understand what it meant. And I kind of reflected back on that the other morning. I just happened to wake up and think about Joyce, you know, because I'm going to be up here with y'all, and she was in the story. And I said, God. I looked up and said, Joyce, I hope you're having a good time. And there was a tingling feeling come over me from my head to my toes, all the way out to my fingertips and my toes, and came back up. And it made me feel so good that I said, God, I don't believe it. If it's any better, I don't believe I can stand it. And I talked to Renelle about that, and she says, oh, I have that all the time. I said, dang, maybe I need to go over into this other program. But that let me know, I think that was God letting me know that, hey, I'm okay. Let it go. I'm okay. Top deal. You know, I seen old Whitey that locked me up. They locked me up in Cobb County for a DUI one time, running 105 miles on Cobb Parkway in a 55 Chevrolet and blue lights. Blue lights come on behind me. He was so close, I thought he was glued to my back bumper. And I used to pour concrete when I was a kid in early in my 20s. I poured concrete, and I worked for a guy named Wilson from Wilson & Sons. They were out of Durango, Colorado, and that's all they did is they poured concrete. They ended up with a concrete plant. And little Willie, his little guy, he'd look at me and he pulled me down and say, don't you ever sign your name on any concrete we lay. We don't do that. You got it? Yes, sir. About 20 years old, I still drinking. And we poured the concrete in the courthouse up there, in the new Marietta courthouse up there, you know. And I was trialing around there, and I said, there's a little old spot there behind that bar. And I put Mike, 67. The year of 67, I was 20. And yeah, you can't see that. Well, years later, when they locked me up and throwed me in the jail up there, I was sitting in the jail up there with not a whole lot to do, you know, and I was kind of looking around. I forgot about it. I put my name over there, and I got looking around there, and I seen some chicken scratching in the corner, and I walked over there and looked, and it said, Mike, 67. I said, there's something wrong with this situation. A cop came by, and I said, I knew his name. I said, hey, Ben, I poured the concrete in this floor up here. And he said, did you figure out to make an escape route while you were doing it? Another spiritual experience, I'm telling you. Well, I got to shut this thing down. Sometime the mind will only comprehend what the butt can stand. You know? Well, I sure appreciate y'all inviting me up here. I use humor. We're not a glum lot. You know, that's why I'm married to Al-Anon. These drunks are a bunch of fun, you know. We're a lot of fun. We have a lot of fun, you know. But I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad you're here, and I hope I've said something that I kind of was hoping a newcomer was here where I could get another sponsee, you know. But, I started to come up and get a chip and lie about it just to get a hug, you know. Anyway, it's good to be here tonight, and I do have a lot of gratitude, and I hope you do. And I love you. All of you. Thank you.